¿Por qué no? Sí, muy, muy inteligente. Tú eres la mejor. Está aquí. ¿Quieres un poquito? Porque entraba en la calle. ¡Qué peligroso! ¡Tú eres tan rápido! ¡Tú eres tan rápido!
¡Haz espacio, por favor!
¡No, más lento! ¡Más lento! ¡No, no más rápido!
Rápido. ¿Y tan
rápido?
No, sí. No necesito algo de eso. Okay, saco los zapatos. No, quieres hibernate. Hibernate.
Super mío.
Ay.
No. December 4th, by the way, Necesitamos con sacar los juguetes primero. Álvaro, venga, tú ayúdate. Venga. No, esto primero. Nada. Nada. Alvarito. ¿Quieres un timeout?
No timeout.
Okay, come on. Putting away is fun too. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, those waffle blocks. May I use this day? He put 2 points to that. Thank you. ¿dónde están los? ¿Dónde está?
¿Dónde?
Sí. Sí.
It's heavy
for you. Qué pesado.
Right now, who has that power? It might be a critic 50 years from now who rediscovers the lost Kurselses, you know, the lost Kurselses, and then all of a sudden, like, how could they have ignored him? Look at, he's doing this. He did this.
The archaeologists in the next century will come back and find your work and say, oh, here is the culture of the 1990s.
They all made rubber band legs. What's with that? What's up? So I make the work that I'm interested in. That's really what it comes down to.
And you hope that the people who come and see it will respond, and the larger questions really don't matter that much more.
Right. I think a lot of artists say, well, I don't care what the audience thinks. I kind of do. I want them to respond to it. I want to make a connection of some sort. I know I won't with everybody, you know, just like people can't agree on what film is the best film they've seen, or, you know, what's good out there. You know, art is even going to be harder, I think, to deal with in that way. You can't make art for everybody, I don't think.
In town to launch his show at the Madison Art Center, Martin Kurselses talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, making art to escape from prison. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Mozart's Symphony No. 40 and Prokofiev's moving tribute to Alexander Nevsky, live and in concert with the Grand Rapids Symphony. Guest conductor David LaBelle leads the orchestra and the symphony chorus in this program of tragedy and triumph. November 20th and 21st at 8 p.m. in DeVos Hall. Tickets are available through Ticketmaster. This performance and announcement are sponsored by the Grand Rapids Symphony.
Many a bored undergraduate staring out the window during a required lecture on English literature's greatest hits has secretly thrilled to a few lines by Richard Lovelace. Stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cage. But tell that to the inmates of a correctional facility where there are no windows to stare out of, and the iron bars are all too real. Prisoners have long found metaphorical escape in the prison library or the gym. Now, in some enlightened institutions, art has opened up another spiritual escape route. Phyllis Kornfeld is an artist and teacher who's been working with prisoners since 1983. She's collected some of the most striking examples of their work in a book called Cell Block Visions, Prison Art in America. Kornfeld told Judith Strasser what it was like the first time she went inside.
You know, I didn't know what to expect when I went in. I don't think I was prejudiced about the inmates, and I had seen a few prison movies. That was about it. So I had no expectations except in the area of art, and that was that all I would see would be biker and tattoo art, you know, the stereotypical prison art, black line drawings in that style, maybe some portraits, maybe some pinups, and that there would just be a dearth of art. There would be no color. There would be no creative energy. So I went in very much thinking that I was the person who knew, and they weren't. I was the artist, and they were not.
Mm-hmm. What did you find?
Well, you know, it blew me away. The first day, the very first day, for example, one man, Braulio Diaz, came into the art class with his arms full. I'd say he had about 60 drawings. They were done on the backs of paper he rescued from the trash. They were exquisite. You know, at that time, there was no talk about what is now known as outsider art or self-taught art. I knew very little about folk art or naive art. And I was very much trained in art history. I had looked at art my whole life. Here was artwork that was so fresh and surprising, vigorous and different. I didn't get it at first. He showed me the materials he used, which were a few broken colored pencils and a ballpoint pen. The man worked on his artwork maybe 22 hours a day. That was how the grapevine had it. The imagery was like nothing had ever seen before.
What was it? I mean,
well, the fantasies that he created were, I don't know how to say it, there was just no cliche about it. He did landscapes with flowers, and he invented these creatures that were turning from caterpillars to butterflies and tree people in what looks like traditional costume of their country, making peace and exchanging gifts.
It sounds like a fantasy of the world that he wished that he was
in. Yeah, I think very much so. I mean, that's his escape, mm-hmm. which is kind of unusual, actually, because most of the inmates I meet are painting about their lives in prison. They are expressing their condition.
The cover of Cell Block Visions is, I don't know who did this, but it's a prison. I mean, you can see all the bars and you see all of the people who are wearing their prison blues. Mm-hmm. And so forth. But the thing that's fascinating to me about it is that it is so colorful. And I have the impression of prisons as being gray.
They are gray, but I think the color here in this painting was painted by Arthur Kegney. It's called Walpole 1972, and it shows a cell block, Block 2, which was known at that time as Death Valley. We're looking at three tiers of cells, and the reason you see so much going on and so much color is because at this period in Walpole's history, and Walpole is Massachusetts maximum security prison, some of the cell blocks were completely out of control. There were a lot of riots, and the guards couldn't get into the cell block, and the inmates couldn't get out, but they had complete run of the block. So Kegney has illustrated all these guys making homebrew mixed with Tang orange drink. We see somebody shooting up in their cell and other men waiting in line. One man has hanged himself. There are holy rollers reading the Bible in one cell. And there's all kinds of activity going on which bring that color.
I'm curious about the kinds of art supplies that were provided or what was available. Did you have to bring your own art supplies with you?
Most of the programs, I get to order the art supplies. And of course, in those early years, I wasn't very hip about what was contraband and what wasn't. And I made a lot of mistakes. Even to this day, some, you know, odd things happened where I'm pretty experienced in knowing what to bring in and what not to bring in.
What can't you bring in?
Well, not very long ago, about a year ago, I was going into one prison, and as I went through each trap or sally port, I ran into an officer, and they kept saying to me, the chief of security wants to see you before you go to your class. And then I go through the next trap, and it was, be sure to go see Captain whoever. You know, this was all very serious, and I finally went to the captain's office. He stood up and pulled out of his desk in a Ziploc bag an eraser, a needed eraser, and he said, so-and-so, this inmate has been in segregation for 5 days now. We caught him with this. He said, you gave it to him. And I said, it's an eraser. So it just turned out that kind of eraser, they felt, could be used to gum up a lock so that a door would appear locked and wouldn't be. You could also make an impression of a key in that eraser. And so the man got out of trouble because I defended him, but I haven't brought that kind of eraser in, so things still keep happening.
What other sorts of things can't you bring in?
Well, you can't bring any wood or metal. Masking tape is delicate. I can bring it in, but I have to really keep my eyes on it. I usually wear it on my wrist because you can use it to make homemade tattoo guns, and you can use it to stabilize the handle of a knife. So I have to be careful about that. I can't bring in any black ink because that's used for tattoo and worth quite a bit of money. It depends on the institution, but I've got it narrowed down to what never gets me any trouble, hopefully.
I'm wondering whether the non-artist population of the prison valued the art that the other people were doing or made fun of it.
There is hardly a non-artist population. You would be quite amazed. The art is crucial. It's all over the place. Everyone's either making it or buying it. It's just extraordinary. That first year I met a man who did the most sophisticated looking, beautiful kind of art deco miniature dioramas, and he made all the figures out of this caulking that he would remove from the windows a little bit at a time until, you know, he had enough clay, he called it, to make a figure. So there's always something you can find. There's quite a lot of interesting sculpture being made with toilet paper. The prison toilet paper is coarse, heavy stuff. You can wet it, mold it. It dries very hard. It's intense, you know, they find anything.
You describe someone scraping the color off of magazine illustrations.
Right. This one guy was driving the CO correctional officer crazy because this was a prison where no art materials were permitted. And yet they would go into his cell and see new colored drawings. And then they'd madly shake down his cell, turn everything upside down looking for these colored pencils. And of course they never found anything. Well, what he was doing was scraping the color off of the glossy colored magazine covers, making this little mound of colored dust. And then he took a pointy object, maybe wrapped some toilet paper around the tip of his pencil and dipped it in the color and drew with that until he used it up and then went on scraping.
It's really amazing. I mean, when you tell these stories, what it makes it sound like is that there's no way of imprisoning the human creative spirit.
That's very well put. And that's what I'm finding. One of the most moving things that's happened to me in all these years just happened a couple of weeks ago. There's an artist in the book named Charles Mosby, who I met in 1987. And he was a perfect example of someone who, he just came to the art class because he was depressed and felt that he was losing his sanity, and he thought that maybe this was a way to save it. He came in and started drawing these very odd creatures, and actually they frightened him because he felt that they were proof of his mm-hmm. loss of sanity. And I did something I rarely do, but I brought in some work to show him of Paul Klee and Joe Miró and people like that, just to let him know that this was a perfectly valid way to work. So he blossomed, and his work is actually quite respected in the art community in New York and collected by people. About a year ago, he was shipped in the middle of the night from his Massachusetts prison to an old county jail in Dallas, Texas, which is privately run, and had rented out cells and beds to the Massachusetts system. A couple of weeks ago, I got a letter from him saying, first of all, he says, I'm totally amazed every day that this place is so cruel. He just can't comprehend, nor can I, what is motivating this kind of cruelty. And at the end of his letter said, I am learning to draw with M&Ms and Skittles. And he sent me the two delicate, lovely, lovely drawings and said, I know these are not as creative as the work I used to do, and I'm having a little trouble in that department, but I know if I keep doing the work, that will come back too.
Wow.
So you're right. It just is irrepressible.
You can see that spirit shining from the pages of Phyllis Kornfeld's Cell Block Visions, Prison Art in America. Judith Strasser talked with her. Thank you. Coming up, writers on painters. And Vincent van Gogh gets a girlfriend. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
To the Best of Our Knowledge on Michigan Radio, your source for NPR News, 91.7 in Ann Arbor, 91.1 in Flint, and 104.1 in Grand Rapids. Coming up at 11 is Sound Money, with a look at what the latest stock market trends could mean for your personal pocketbook. Stay with us.
Before she knew who he was, or had ever thought she would see him again after she left the hospital. Working man's clothes, rough and made of spun iron, and his worker's boots, cleanly oiled and old and tired of life, having walked up and down the stony, broken paths by smooth roads where the poor and other outcasts were not invited to walk, and where he had chosen to walk among them.
That reverent view of Van Gogh as an almost saintly figure is central to Frederick Tutton's take on the artist. He thinks Van Gogh was not only a great painter, but a pilgrim on a profound spiritual quest. Tutton told Steve Folson that when he looks at Vincent's paintings, he sees more than sunflowers, or starry nights, or crows over a wheat field. He sees
tragic beauty, imminence of death, maybe the beauty of death, sadness for him, sadness for his loneliness, wishing in some strange way that I might have been a friend of his to comfort him, thinking about his nobility as an artist and his measure as a person, his greatness as a person, his deep humanity, all those things. I mean, one doesn't say those words to oneself as you see it. It doesn't come across that way, but it's the feelings that you know are there because of him.
So Van Gogh's loneliness really resonated for you?
Profoundly. I felt it spiritually. I think he was tremendously lonely spiritually, and searching for God to fill that loneliness. I know it sounds very dramatic, but if you read the letters, you see that it's there, it's implicit. This profound passion for God, which I think was a way of filling up the space in him, and as well as for painting. I mean, this passion for painting was a way of, I think, praying. I think it was a way of talking to God and to us, and of filling up this vacuum in himself.
What does he say about that, about his passion for God?
Everywhere. Well, as you know, he became a sort of lay minister, and tried very much to preach to coal miners, the most abject of all the coal miners in a place called the Boniage near Belgium. He tried that for a while. He was a very devout Christian, and that didn't work out for him. But I think that even though that role of his, the actual role of minister of faith, was not open to him, he was a person who was ministering all the time in some deeper way, perhaps. Not necessarily a way that has to do only with Christ, but certainly a way it has to do with a spiritual nature of God infusing everything, infusing the landscape, infusing the humblest of things, even a pair of shoes. It's in his letters. I mean, all his letters talk about this in some way or another.
Sounds like you're saying that you really can't appreciate his paintings properly unless you know something about his life.
I don't think so. I think we can appreciate it very deeply. I think it enhances the appreciation if we know something about his life. I think if you care for the paintings, if you love the paintings, and I think if you see enough of them, you really will feel that love. Then I think you'd want to know about the person who made them. And I think knowing that about him and reading about him and studying about him, I don't mean in any academic way. I mean in a way that you care about a friend. I think it infuses the paintings with much more power.
Well, let's talk about the paintings themselves for a moment. What is it about them that is so striking to you?
Well, it's a very good question, because for me, the world of painting is divided into two ways of thinking about art. And one has to do with Cézanne, which I find having to do with art, which refers to itself, art as the object of itself. And the other is Vincent, who I think is someone making art which tells us more about the thing it's being described, as well as what is in the painting. I think what I see in his painting is a way of looking at the moment. It's a way of looking at the sky, the way of looking at the earth, the way of looking at a chair. Makes me feel intense about those things. It makes me feel passionate about those things.
Now, the popular image that we have of Van Gogh is that he was a madman, a great artist, but a madman, and to some degree, the two things seem to be linked. Is that popular image more or less accurate?
I wouldn't say madman. I would say unhappy man, and I would say self-destructive man, and I would say self-destructive. I mean, physically, we know he injured himself, and finally he killed himself. But I would say madmen assume somehow that you are not in control of your faculties and that you can't function rationally, and he was able to at all times. He was distraught. He was a hurt man. He was an injured man and a profoundly lonely one. He sought and wished for a life of normalcy, and that wasn't open to him. I don't think he could do the work he did in 10 years. After all, he painted from 27 to 37 before he died. 10 years in which he produced these immense amounts of paintings. It was a total commitment. So I don't think there was much room in any case for any other kind of life.
And he had very little feedback, didn't he? I mean,
very little
positive feedback.
He sold one painting in his lifetime. A few painters knew him and loved his work and understood his work. Gauguin was one of them. He's in my novel. I bring Gauguin into the book, too. I have them set up as a kind of little dialogue of antagonist dialogue between them. But certain people knew about the work and appreciated the work. There were people, Pissarro and others, who knew the work and cared for it. But as far as the wider audience was concerned, he was non-entity. He didn't exist.
Do you think Gauguin was more a friend or more a rival?
Both. I think they were friends who were rivals and rivals who were friends.
Which I suppose adds to the poignancy of the whole story.
I think so. Their whole relationship. I think Vincent loved him very much and missed him when he left. I think he was one of the few anchors he had in his life, and that disappeared, too.
So when Gauguin
left? When Gauguin finally left, yeah, when he left all to go to Brittany and left the relationship, really.
Well, let's talk about your novel, Van Gogh's Bad Café, because you've done something rather interesting. You've introduced time travel into this, and you've brought together two centuries, the late 19th and the late 20th centuries, and two places, France and New York City, to create a novel that both is about Van Gogh's time and about our own time. What made you want to do this?
Well, that's something I can't explain rationally. I can't say I had a diagram in my brain for it, but I do know that I wanted somehow Vincent, through maybe a surrogate, the woman he loves, Ursula, to be brought into the 20th century as a witness to our time and to the disintegrations, I think, that she sees in our time as compared to the late 19th century. But I wanted Vincent, above all, to be in love with someone as brilliant as he, as passionate as he, as spiritually profound as he, and as destroyed as he. And I wanted that person to exist in our time, to bring to bear another kind of relationship she has with the narrator of this book, who finds in her the same beauty and excitement that Vincent did.
And you could not do that just by writing a historical novel?
No, I've never written just an historical novel, and I don't know why. I'm finding it always tempting to bring myself back into the 20th century, wherever I am. I did a novel about the French Revolution called Tallien, A Brief Romance, and there it's about the French Revolution itself and about this man Tallien, a young revolutionary, and then it's also about a man who's a union organizer in the 20th century. Somehow I'd like to see parallels in some way, or contrasts between times, or have one time tell about another time in some way.
Do you see parallels between these two times?
Well, 1890s and today, of course, are the times when we are waiting for the millennium. We're waiting for the end of the century. We're waiting with some anxiety, I think, even if it's quiet anxiety, for that which will be new, that which will bring us something that we don't know, perhaps, a world that we don't know. I think that was there, certainly in the 1890s. It's there in their literature. It's there in the literature of Oscar Wilde and literature of Walter Pater. And it's a vast literature of a certain kind of anxiety. And I suspect we may be thinking that, even though it's a calm period in America and a very, very fruitful period in America, I have a suspicion we're also wondering what's going to happen now, what this new world will bring us once we turn over the bridge of the 21st century.
My sense, though, from what you said earlier, is that we've lost something, that we would do well to remember what life was like in Van Gogh's own time.
Well, I think we've lost a few things. I think we've lost... I have a feeling we lost a certain kind of spirituality that I think he represented. A secular spirituality, if it seems like an oxymoron, maybe it is. But a passion for art that I think that he could feel and believe in, and as well as other artists. I think that a certain kind of passion that generation, Gauguin and Cézanne and Van Gogh and Pissarro, I think that they believed in art as a totality. I think they believed in it as something nourishing to the community. Vincent really does speak of it that way in his letters.
And people,
it's not just a thing on the wall for people to collect.
And artists today don't have that kind of passion?
Today?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just really don't know. I don't sense it. It's not in the conversations I hear among artists. And maybe they're secretly saying that. Maybe they think it's sentimental to say it. But I don't know. I don't hear it, and I don't recognize the impulse today. I don't recognize the impulse that would see art as a transcendental activity, bringing some spiritual world to the community.
Vincent van Gogh lives again in Frederick Tutton's novel Van Gogh's Bad Cafe, a love story. The author talked with Steve Paulson. The Underpainter, Canadian writer Jane Urquhart has created an artist who's the temperamental opposite of Vincent van Gogh. Austin Fraser has a superb visual memory and great technical skill, but no emotional attachment to the world he so vividly depicts in his work. I asked Jane Urquhart how such a visual person could have such a huge blind spot.
I would describe him as a complicated man who has been affected by the various fashions that have come and gone in the 20th century visual art world, and who has also suffered from the belief that art is more important than life. He's a very distant, voyeuristic kind of person. I myself do not dislike him. I felt, in fact, quite close to him while I was writing the book, but I have talk to people who have had a number of problems with him. Now, having said I didn't dislike him, I nevertheless was at moments quite angry with him.
He's a fascinating character. There is, as you say, this distance between him and the world that's around him. But he's very aware of the physical detail,
yes,
of the world around him. He knows every last fiber of every last piece of cloth. But there is that distance always between what he can see and any kind of understanding of it.
Yes, I think that it's one of the strange paradoxes of his what is essentially called eidetic or eidetic condition, which is the ability to re-vision things that one has already seen to the extent that it's almost hallucinatory. One would imagine that would be a very intimate.
About to address the nation this morning about the situation in Iraq, the president and his national security team have been assessing Iraq's offer to allow the resumption of UN weapons inspections in Iraq. That offer was enough to put a halt to the immediate attack on Iraq, which the president had authorized. But yesterday, National Security Advisor Sandy Berger characterized that offer as unacceptable because it sought to impose conditions on the deal. We are being told now that the president may be addressing the nation at about 11 o'clock this morning, which will be in about 10 minutes' time. Meanwhile, we are joined by NPR's Mike Schuster in New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Leanne.
Can you tell me, did events overnight at the UN Security Council, was there anything that happened overnight that would have prompted President Clinton to address the nation? By that I mean, were there developments that would lead the U.S. to perhaps be more sympathetic to Iraq's position?
Well, I'm not sure anything happened in the Security Council that would have caused that. There were big disagreements in the Security Council last night, and the Council was unable to respond in a kind of unified way to either the Iraqi statement, the Iraqi reversal, or the U.S. reaction to that, which was to reject it as conditional. And perhaps the disagreements and the different interpretations in the Council may have affected the President and his national security team, because, in fact, the Russians, the French, the Chinese, and the U.N. Secretary General himself said that this was a step in the right direction and looked upon it positively. So there are a lot of people out there, a lot of nations that that assume that in fact Iraq had reversed itself and backed down on this. And the Iraqis themselves, in particular their UN ambassador, were, to me, seemed desperate to convince the administration that in fact what came from Baghdad yesterday was an unconditional reversal of their refusal to work with the UN weapons inspectors.
Do you think they've been effective? Do you think indeed, based on perhaps what we think the president might say, do you think that has been effective?
I think it probably has. It seems to me that it would be difficult at this point in this particular crisis as it unfolds for the United States to launch airstrikes against Baghdad at this moment. I think that would, it would accomplish something as far as the United States is concerned in its campaign to contain and hurt Saddam Hussein. But I think the fallout from that diplomatically would probably be far worse.